Welcome back to the third and final part of Meryl Streep, Bad, Badder, and Baddest. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
It's only been three episodes, but it's been an amazing journey.
It has, yeah.
Typically, we structure these three parts around the good, the bad, and the crazy. Arguably, we've only had bad, but if we had bad, good, bad, bad, this film, She-Devil, I think we picked it because we kind of felt, well, this will be pretty crazy, right? Mm-hmm. This will be Meryl Streep, bad in a campy, kind of fun, kind of crazy way. Because all you have to do is say to yourself, Meryl Streep versus Roseanne Barr. That's what She-Devil is. It's a pairing of these two complete polar opposites. And on paper, I guess, maybe that's funny. Maybe that's at least good enough for a crazy midnight viewing.
Yeah.
I can detect from the tone of your voice that it did not live up to those expectations.
Well, you can also detect by my body language, Brian, as I sit here, arms folded, prepared to talk about what I think is one of the worst films we've ever had to talk about on this podcast.
It's funny, because usually I'm the one who gets the most incensed about these things. I found She-Devil boring, odd, and just, like, bizarrely conceived, but you were really, really upset.
Every aspect of this film, all the individual parts, are corrupted, okay? And together, you create just one, you know, well of loneliness, okay?
A putrefying mass.
It's a putrefying mass. It's a poison well, okay, of entertainment. And that's what I think She-Devil is.
Or anti-entertainment, possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's good on paper, isn't it?
Yeah, on paper. But as we were watching this film, I realized that for the majority of it, my face was resting. Okay, it wasn't even in a smile. And in the humorous parts, it may kind of like curl up at the edges a little bit. There were very few moments, albeit a couple, where I chuckled or snorted or something. But there was very little laughter in the supposed comedy.
And this is odd too, because like, okay, I guess for viewers in 1989, the idea of Meryl Streep, acclaimed greatest actress of all time, master of every accent, queen of quality filmmaking, the idea of putting her into this has a kind of shock value on its own, especially pairing her with Roseanne Barr, who was known as a vulgar stand-up comedian whose material was all about being the so-called domestic goddess and this kind of brash, overweight, aggressive feminism. She had her hit and acclaimed TV series, Roseanne. Like, how do you think a 1989 audience responded to the idea, just the idea, of Meryl doing comedy?
With suspicion.
Meaning, like, why would we want to see that woman do any comedy at all?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'll answer your question. But first, I want to answer another one you didn't ask, which is why did Meryl do this film in the first place?
Sure.
Okay, so this is a film from 1989. Okay, let's just say Meryl's been making films since 77. Okay,
yeah.
Manhattan, Julia. So, and like, you look at all those films in that decade-plus period. They are all really heavy, okay?
Hmm.
From Karen Silkwood to Lindy Chamberlain and the Queen of Africa, whatever her name is, in between.
Okay. Isaac Dinesen.
Isaac Dinesen, yeah. I love his music.
Karen von Blixen.
He's an amazing artist, you know. Like, those films, while prestigious, are not exactly popcorn movies.
They're not light.
They're not light. And Meryl's been doing this for 12 years, so I really, really sympathize with her in thinking, you know what, yes, I've got awards. Yes, I get good reviews. But does anyone ever say, wow, can't wait to see this new Meryl Streep movie? No. And she probably said, I'm fed up and wanted to do a comedy. And we know from this point onwards that comedy was something she did on occasion after that.
And with increasing frequency. But like, having watched this movie, having it assault my eyeballs, it's amazing to me. Like, this movie is not funny. It's a total misfire, in my opinion.
And it didn't do very well at the box office.
It didn't do very well at the box office. So it's kind of amazing that anyone ever let Meryl do comedy again.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of a dress rehearsal. And I think this is the first time people were like, Meryl Streep in a comedy? Really? And the second time she does a comedy, it's kind of like, oh yeah, but she was in that She-Devil thing. It's a precedent-making opportunity, even if it's a total failure.
Is it kind of like, I mean, I'm not a potter, But, you know, like when you throw your first pot and you put it in the kiln and it like comes out misshapen and doesn't even look like a pot.
I guess it's exactly like that.
Call up Demi Moore.
Yeah.
She would know.
She knows everything.
Okay, so I'm going to try to explain, like, what the heck She-Devil is. Maybe you can help me here, because I'm not even sure who's supposed to be the She-Devil.
Yeah, when you talk about what this film is about, I think it almost resembles what a plot kind of is in theory.
It's the kind of thing that you think would just be, like, a high-concept sort of gag movie, but actually it's based on a novel by someone that I've really never heard of called Faye Weldon.
Yeah, Faye Weldon is a popular feminist writer of novels. You know, I think she's still living, but she...
She's English, yeah. Okay.
And the life and times of a She-Devil was quite a big hit when it came out in the early 80s, and there was even a sequel, I think, called like, The Life and Death of a She-Devil a few years later.
Can you, like, place Faye Weldon for me? Like, is she the kind of writer that your mother might have read her books?
I doubt my mother ever read any Faye Weldon, but I will ask her once this podcast is over. But I think I'd remember my mother reading a book called The Cloning of Joanna May, okay, at some point in my life.
Are you reading off the Wikipedia page here?
Yeah, or maybe The Spa Decameron, or maybe The Shrapnel Academy. You know, I'd remember these titles.
These are memorable titles. They sound very zeitgeisty to me.
Yeah, but there's also titles in there, things like The Lives and Loves of Men of Blah, you know?
Okay. Well, so somehow this book becomes a property that someone wants to develop into a film. And I hadn't realized until we sat down to watch it that it was directed by Susan Seidelman.
Now, who the hell is that?
You know, Desperately Seeking Susan.
Ah, yes.
Get into the groove, boy. You've got to something your love to
you've
me.
You've got to prove your love to me.
Okay, so like,
yeah.
So we've gotta give Susan Seidelman credit. She helped launch one of the greatest film careers of all time,
Rosanna Arquette.
No, but seriously, she has at least the chutzpah to cast people like Madonna and Roseanne Barr in leads. So she's not against kind of stunt casting,
yeah,
of sort of non-film actors.
I would also, yeah, argue that Meryl Streep is stunt casting.
Yeah, and so it's Meryl Streep is doing stunt casting here. And as far as I know about Susan Seidelman, she was like a kind of downtown female director, right? In a time period where there were even fewer female directors than there are now who could get their pictures made. So that makes it interesting to me. She's decided to do this Streep versus Roseanne thing. And Roseanne plays a woman named Ruth, who is what? Like a frumpy, put-upon housewife, right? We meet her, and kind of, what does she look like? How does she act?
Well, she's unattractive. She's dumpy, and she's cumbersome.
They've even put, like, a prosthetic mole on her face.
They've put, like, a comedy mole on her face.
Yeah.
She's also treated to be kind of just, like, completely ineffectual in every sense.
And obviously, Roseanne's persona as a stand-up comic and on her show has been to, like, deconstruct, like, the housewife mythology, right? But, like, the Roseanne of the TV show Roseanne is very outspoken, and she's kind of, like, the lord of her roost and kind of snapping at her kids and, you know, she's kind of like a working-class heroine. The Ruth of this movie is kind of a non-entity as a character, at least at the start, for sure. Her delivery is very flat. The character, I understand she's supposed to be kind of passive. She hasn't had her feminist awakening. But it's like, Roseanne is not funny.
Yeah, this is a film full of non-entities. Roseanne is not funny because the material is not good enough for her.
Well, she's just...
I mean, I know she's deplorable, okay? Let's just get that out of the way. It's just that she can do better than this, and she could have written better material herself.
Well, yeah. Whatever kind of Kool-Aid Roseanne has now drunk that has turned her into a racist bigot and conspiracy theorist on Twitter, that had not emerged in 1989 to its fullest extent. It was still possible to be a kind of woke person and cheer Roseanne on for her presence in the culture back in those days, yeah?
Yeah.
But, like, I'm just simply talking about, like, the comic value of what she's doing in this movie. Like, she is nominally our heroine. She's married to an accountant, played by
Ed Begley Jr.
Yes. How did you feel about Ed Begley Jr., either physically or as an actor?
Well, Ed Begley Jr. was, I think he guest starred as, like, in a two-parter of Star Trek Voyager. I think he was a kind of a villain. And so that's where I remember him from. Or maybe he was a romantic lead. Either way, he was in a pivotal moment of my adolescence.
That's fine. I'm asking about your opinion of him in this movie.
Yeah, I would.
Oh, so it's just pure fuckability. That's how you rank your male leads in these films.
Well, this isn't a podcast about men, Brian, is it? Okay, I can't do two things at once.
Well, you know, I'm totally not into blondes, and he has that like floppy haired blonde thing going
on. It's so funny because you're basically into anything with a pulse. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but blondes just don't cut it with you, do they?
No. I mean, maybe there's a Robert Redford in the 70s exception, but that's
Hubble?
About it. Hubble.
Hubble?
Talking about the space telescope? Okay.
So, answer me, Hubble?
I mean, who wouldn't do Hubble?
Okay.
Political viewpoints aside. Okay. Anyway, Ed Begley Jr., though. So he's an accountant. He's a sort of a mid-level successful CPA, right? He's kind of trying to get higher profile clients. So he takes Roseanne to this swanky gala at the Guggenheim. She has to get herself into a classy dress, but she really looks out of place as a kind of suburban housewife who does not fit in with the champagne-swilling, you know, cognoscenti. Who do they run into but...
Well, who does she step onto?
Yeah, literally, there's a comic meet-cute and a kind of spilling of... what does she spill on her? Red wine? Yeah, red wine onto the dress of someone who really fits into this world, someone who is glamorous and successful and gorgeous, who's rich and pretty and thin, yes, as they say. That woman is...
Mary Fisher.
Now, can you give us a sampling of how Meryl Streep, in the role of Mary Fisher, talks?
Well, it's the first time that Meryl does her breathy voice. And by that I mean, she kind of talks like this.
It's also at a higher register.
It's a, for example, when Roseanne spills the wine on her, Ed Begley demands that Roseanne go and get some salt and Perrier. And Meryl's like, salt and Perrier? A man who knows a woman's domain. And it's that.
Yeah.
Most of the film.
It's like, she's doing, I mean, Meryl has commented many times in interviews and her Barnard acceptance speech about, like, the performance of femininity,
yeah,
that she remembers having done when she was a girl in high school. I think, actually, Michael wrote about this in Her Again, right? That kind of, like, in order to be attractive to men, she kind of plays a little bit dumb and self-consciously behaves in a girly manner, you know? Mm-hmm. I think she said that maybe Linda in The Deer Hunter is, like, a version of that cheerleader self that she, yeah, had. So she's clearly doing something in the role of Mary Fisher that's saying, okay, this woman is someone for whom femininity and makeup and romance, that's her way of gaining success because she writes these novels that show to women that they can allow their men to be men. And as soon as Ed Begley swans into view, she's attracted to him, she has her eyes set on him, and she kind of angles to basically steal him from Roseanne.
Yeah, and I will say in Meryl's defense that at least she and her performance are as ludicrous as everything else in this picture. She tacks on to the tone of this, which is just completely nonsensical.
Well, I guess while Roseanne seems to almost be anesthetized, like, Roseanne is really not giving it a lot of gusto compared to, like, what we know she can do. Like, there's no crotch-grabbing performance of the National Anthem here. It's really, like, she seems...
That would have been interesting.
Yeah, it would have been great.
I would have loved if it incorporated that into the story somehow.
The film just stopped. She sings the National Anthem in the middle of the Guggenheim and grabs her crotch.
I would have liked that. I would have been into that. I would have had a surrealist element.
That would have perked you up. But maybe it's in the director's cut. We have to call Susan Sidelman. But anyway, Roseanne seems kind of blank and anesthetized. Meryl is at least, like, she's giving it some kind of gusto. Like, she's bounding around. She's bouncing around. She's, like, making goofy faces. To my taste, it is just still not funny.
No, it's not.
I mean, can we just, like, run through kind of the basic outlines of what happens? Because she does steal Ed Begley away from Roseanne.
Yes.
Right? He's conducting an affair. He takes her on as a client. She doesn't know anything about taxes. Oh my God, you mean you think you could help me, like, get even more money? And she lives in this big pink mansion that seems to only have two servants.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, the servants do, later on, do say, when I took this job, it was just to do one thing for one person. And now I have all these people in the house, okay?
Right, okay, but the two servants are a kind of butler come gigolo who's named Garcia.
Yeah, who has a lovely kind of 80s mullet that I got.
Yeah,
and a quite a nice body, I have to say.
It's true, it's that funny way that they loved in the 80s and early 90s to represent, like, hunky Latin lovers. Mm-hmm. They kind of always walk around with their shirts sort of semi-exposed.
They're always kind of petulant.
They're also, like, vaguely gay. Like, there's this idea that any kind of body beautiful man is slightly feminized.
That is a very interesting point. It's like, that period in history, it's like, if you associate male desirability, you kind of have to temper it with a little bit of, they're a bit...
light in the loafers.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Death Becomes Her, doesn't Isabella Rossellini have, like, a harem of similar shirtless men?
Well, that's it, exactly. And those men, while are supposed to be her lovers, have that weird kind of European campiness to them that makes you wonder, are they gay or are they just foreign?
I guess you're meant to believe that Mary Fisher in her pink penthouse, like, has been stupping Garcia the butler.
Yes.
But, like, Meryl does not exude a lot of authentic sexuality.
No, even though there are plenty of examples where she is being sexual on screen. But
right,
in,
like,
that completely marshmallow, bubblegum, pink unicorns kind of way.
Well, like, explain that. So, like, she and Ed Begley start conducting this affair.
Yeah.
She has this giant, like, poof of a bed,
yeah,
which is, like, big and pink.
Yeah, and there's scenes in which they're writhing around going, and then, like, and then, like, rolling around again in the sheets.
You must lead a very glamorous life, Mary.
I suppose so, Bob, but sometimes sitting here day after day banging away at my keyboard, writing can be so lonely.
I guess you've got to have a very vivid imagination to write these romance novels, don't you?
Yes, I do. But I also do a lot of research.
Comically grabbing each other, professing love and desirability for each other, all in a very kind of romance novel cover kind of way.
There's a bit of a fellatio interruptus at one point.
There is, and I will give Meryl credit for that. For actually, you know, if you're ever in a Meryl pub quiz where you have to identify in which film does Meryl give a blowjob.
I believe it's Begins to give one.
She gives one.
It's implied.
It's implied she gives a blowjob. It's Ed Begley in She-Devil,
that's
FYI.
That's probably the only one.
It is probably the only one. And you know, something that I've always thought about in Meryl's entire career is that she's an actress who I don't think has ever shown her body on screen. And if anything, has been very protective of it. And I totally respect that. I mean, how many men get their junk out on screen? Not that many, I can assure you. But Meryl, like, you think of, like, Charlotte Rampling, Helen Mirren,
Isabelle Huppert, Julianne Moore.
Do you know what I mean? Julianne Moore is a really great example because she has done her share of, like, action movies, serious adult dramas, comedies, auteurist-led types of films, and things like The Hunger Games. And she is, on regular occasions, shown off her body on screen. Again, that's her choice to make. I just am fascinated by the fact that Meryl has never, you know, done nudity. And to be honest, like, it's in a film like this, or It's Complicated, for example, in which there are so many scenes of, like, bedroom antics that, you know, Meryl's constantly holding the sheet to her chest as she runs after her lover. And I always find that deeply embarrassing. When's the last time you put on any clothes after getting with someone?
Okay, sure. But I guess, you know, Nancy Meyers and Bernardo Bertolucci are two different filmmakers, okay? So it's like, even in someone who's been in a lot of those kind of comic sex farces, you don't necessarily expect to see everything. But it is really apparent that Meryl is clutching the sheets to herself.
Oh,
like,
clutching.
She doesn't want to show anything. And actually, maybe one of the most surprising elements of this movie is how much male flesh you do see, because there's an extended bit where Ed Begley has been caught by Roseanne and is kind of running in a really skimpy pink towel, and then you do see a big old shot of his butt, naked butt.
Yeah, you do. Well, that's the beauty of having female directors, Brian.
It's true.
Barbara proved this to us in those gratuitous shots of Mandy in Intel.
Yep, but give me Mandy any day. He's not a blonde. Okay, so basically, the plot sort of leaps forward because, okay, his affair with Mary Fisher, Meryl Streep, is exposed. Roseanne goes berserk. Well, she decides to enact revenge, and I kind of think, like, this is where we were expecting, okay, this is going to be what? Like, Monster-in-Law or something, right? Where it's, like, J-Lo versus Jane Fonda. There's going to be screaming catfights, like, comic set pieces as Meryl and Roseanne go at it. And they barely have any scenes together.
They have a scene at the beginning where she spills the wine. They have a scene in which Roseanne, in wanting to get her life back, dumps her children with Ed Begley to be like, well, you're their father too. And then at the very end of the film, I think,
she exerts this revenge on Ed Begley and Meryl, but it's all, you know, from a distance. it's not head on. And she has this like list. She's like, here are the things that I will get my husband on.
Yeah, the things that he claims are most important to a
like
man.
Like his home, his reputation, his career, his finances.
Yeah.
Yeah? But she goes about it in this very convoluted way. So the first thing is the home, which she destroys. Through, and actually, like, while juvenile and done on a semi-budgetary shoestring, like, the scene of her burning down the house was actually one of the more enjoyable parts of the film.
Oh, that's because it was one of the most inventive as to how can you blow up your house, you know? Well, here are the many ways.
Well, it also had this kind of feminist art project type of level, because she's, like, taking all the trappings of domestic womanhood, like household appliances and, like, cleaning products, and she's, like, using those as the weapons to, like, destroy the house.
Agreed,
right?
Very interesting.
Like, exploding aerosol cans and putting, like, toasters in the bathtub and stuff like that. I mean, how did you like the special effects when the house finally explodes?
Well, I mean, green screen was state-of-the-art at that point.
But it kind of, like, it feels like Susan Sidelman knows that no one's going to believe this is real, so she's kind of playing up the fakeness of how it looks. Like, if the whole movie had that kind of tongue-in-cheek, I mean, I guess it sort of does. It just doesn't really let... Anyway, she blows up the house. The kids are shocked to see that mom's destroyed the house. I kind of like the kids.
They're very 80s kids. I think kids in the... I will say, kids in the contemporary cinema are fudging boring, okay?
Yeah, like, what's his name in The River Wild?
No, that's fine. That kid is good. You see him as a good example.
Well, I don't like him.
No, but I thought he was okay. Again, I gotta tell our listeners, on our way back from the USA, I tried to watch It's Complicated on the plane, and I had to turn it off.
But those are adult children.
It doesn't matter. No, some of them are still youngish, okay? Is this what children are like in film and television today? They're awful. I would prefer if they were putting pet mice in, you know, people's underwear, okay? And stabbing milk cartons in the supermarket. Bring back the problem child. That's what I want to say.
Yeah, these kids are like kind of holy terrors.
Yeah.
And so Roseanne decides to dump the kids with Ed and Meryl in Meryl's pink palace. And that seems to be her strategy. Her strategy is like, okay, well, if this woman wants my husband, then she also has to take the kids. Now, here's where there's just like a big logical flaw, okay?
Yeah.
Meryl's character is this romance novelist who's not had to deal with any like complications in her life. And suddenly these kids are dumped on her. Now, if those are your stepchildren and you're insanely rich, do you do the children's laundry? Do you spend any time with the children? No, you send them to boarding school. Or you, like, hire a bunch of other people to take care of them. Like, having these kids in this giant pink house would not actually destroy Meryl Streep's career or life.
Yeah, you know what would have been interesting? If the people she hired couldn't hack it either. You know what I mean? Well, and then consequently she was left with them.
Like pay lip service to that because Garcia and the German maid kind of are like, we can't deal with this. But it's like, okay, but you've literally only got two staff in your house? Like,
well, actually, Garcia gets involved with them. You remember?
Yeah, doesn't he like make out with the teenage daughter?
No, he has a very seductive
tango
with the daughter while she's wearing Mary's clothes.
And the boy actually gets into the like Courvoisier or something and starts guzzling wrestling it, gets drunk and like pukes on Mary's rug.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
That was a funny sight.
I respect that. I honor that.
Okay, and then into the picture waltzes another Academy Award winner. This movie actually has two Academy Award winning actresses in it. Meryl, who at that time had two Oscars, and someone else, Sean.
Linda Hunt.
So why do you say it with that tone?
No, I just the way I say her name.
We love Linda Hunt,
we
don't
do
we?
We love Linda.
Linda Hunt, acclaimed theater actress, of course, won for Year of Living Dangerously, in which she played a man.
Yeah.
Fascinating casting.
Fascinating casting.
So here she is. So how does she and Roseanne meet?
Well, Roseanne, in one of the more ridiculous, convoluted, and surely makes sense to someone in the production of
Faye
this
Weldon.
Film. Maybe. Yeah, so Roseanne goes to work in the rest home where Mary Fisher's mother is, and she takes on the name Vesta Rose, okay? In this nursing home. What? Yeah?
Why does she need to take on that name of all names?
Well, remember, she looks at a rose. Remember, she's looking at a rose and says, Rose. That part I understand, but like, Vesta. I mean, was she asked this question in the vestibule? I don't know. I want to know why anyone is called Vesta. Can you please tell me?
I don't know.
Okay. So, she's called Vesta Rose. And she meets Hooper, who kind of looks like a drag impersonation of Linda Hunt, I have to say. What's with that little weird hat she wears on the top of her
can
head?
I just pause for a minute? Because while we were watching the movie, I was like, oh, Linda Hunt hasn't been in anything recently. And Sean said, well, she was in The Incredibles. And I was like, no, she's not. Just for the record, Linda Hunt is not the voice of the woman who designs the costume in The Incredibles. She just looks like
that. I thought that was Linda
Hunt. That is not Linda Hunt.
Okay.
She is the voice, however, of the tree in Pocahontas.
That is true. Okay. She is.
So Linda Hunt, who is a very short woman, yes?
Yeah.
I mean, she's kind of a comic pairing with Roseanne.
Yeah, again, not funny.
Yeah. So they're these put-upon nurses in this rest home, and what do?
Well, they liberate the inhabitants of the nursing home. They free Mary Fisher's mother from her state of convalescence to turn her into kind of an Estelle Getty body snatcher, and send her off to live with Mary, and the mother is this caustic, foul-mouthed, you know, truth-telling, complete antithesis to the daughter of hers, who tells reporters everything and, you know, basically kind of goes on the side of the kids.
It causes a lot of bad PR for Mary. There's a scathing People magazine cover story revealing her past and her illegitimate child.
And her real age and all that kind of stuff.
In a fascinating turn of events, Linda Hunt and Roseanne open up an employment agency for women who've been left behind. And again, like, in theory, this is an interesting plot line, but it's, like, so not developed.
Yeah.
Like, many of the women that they seem to be employing are, like, people of color or people who have, like, odd body types or, like, you know, wouldn't...
People who don't have the same opportunities or never had. But, and I like that.
But, like, weirdly, like, none of them are developed as characters. Like, it actually... We've compared it to Monster in Law. You almost might also compare it to another unsuccessful movie we watched a while ago, which is The Associate, where Whoopi Goldberg and Diane Wiest kind of join forces to kind of take down the patriarchy by starting their own investment bank.
I have a real soft spot for that film. I really do.
That film is far more interesting on a feminist kind of going against the hegemony level.
And race, don't forget race.
Yeah, and race, than this, because this one, it's like they're paying lip service to that kind of thing, but if they're gonna do that as a plot, like, it has to be developed further, because essentially it's like they seem to go through all this trouble to, like, liberate an entire rest home, found an employment agency, make it successful. It's all so that eventually, in the long run, Ed Begley will hire one temp secretary who they've, like, planted so that they can get into his office. They know Ed will start having an affair with this secretary. They'll get into his computer files and reveal that he's been, like, engaged in, like, financial misdeeds.
Yeah.
They'll start fooling around with the cat. Like, it just seems so complex.
Yeah.
And it never brings Roseanne into direct conflict with either Ed or Meryl.
Yeah.
So, like, on these parallel tracks, like, Meryl is disintegrating, and her novels are getting worse because she has to handle her mother and the kids, and, like, her agent is like, why is your latest romance novel about a woman, like, struggling with the rinse cycle in the washing machine? Like, that's the feminist point of this, yeah?
Yeah.
I guess. The novel's a flop. Meryl's disintegrating. In the end, Roseanne gets the IRS to arrest Ed. And how does it all kind of play out?
How it plays out is that Mary realizes that she's been duped by Ed Begley. She realizes the error of her ways, and she becomes a much more relatable woman who writes contemporary literature about what it means to be a woman in love. And she starts looking like Meryl from Kramer vs. Kramer in Manhattan.
Yeah, she has, like, big glasses and, like, severe hair pulled back, and she basically looks like an Upper West Side New Yorker.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what we expect Meryl to look like.
Ed Begley goes to jail for 14 months.
Yeah, even Paul Manafort's going to jail for longer than that.
Yeah. And what he seems to be rehabilitated within moments, and Roseanne goes back on her way again.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of implied that they sort of patch things up, even if they're remaining divorced. And the movie just kind of ends, and you never get, like, the big feminist payoff or the kind of explosions. Well, you get a literal explosion of the house.
Yeah.
But it kind of, in terms of character or comic explosions, it never quite goes very far.
Yeah. Now, what I will say about this before we get Michael in is that I think were it not for She-Devil, we wouldn't have had Madeline Ashton a few years later in my favorite film, Death Becomes Her. Well, one of my favorite films, which I'm going to watch clips of as soon as we finish this podcast.
Do you have any idea whether Michael likes this or not?
I hope he hates it, but I don't think that's the case.
Okay. Well, I may have to be the referee between the two of you, one She-Devil and another. For one final time, should we call up Michael Schulman?
Yeah, let's get Michael in here.
Okay.
Andy!
I found him!
Hi, Daddy.
Who let you in here, Garcia?
Ruth, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Andy, Nicolette, this is your new home. I'm sure you'll be very happy here.
Ruth, you are really depraved.
Someone get this deranged woman out of here. Garcia!
You take care, kids. And remember, no matter what, I love you both very much.
Ruth? Ruth, if this is your idea of a joke, it's not funny. Okay, Ruth. Give you a few days, then you've got to come back for the kids. Where can I reach you?
I'm not coming back, Bob. They'll have a much better life here with you.
Wait a minute, Ruth. Where are you going?
I don't know, Bob. Into my future, I guess.
Ruth! Ruth! Ruth!
Okay, joining us on the line for what I promise is the last time, Michael, okay, you can leave the house once we're done with this. It's Michael Schulman once again, everybody, and he is here to have what I'm sure is going to be a very heated discussion. Michael, thanks for being back.
Hi.
Michael, as the historian of Meryl Streep's career, is it fair to say that She-Devil is the very first comedy that she ever did?
Not quite. You could call Heartburn a comedy. That was earlier.
Oh, yeah. But it's not very funny.
Manhattan's a comedy. This is the first kind of, like, comedy, B-movie kind of comedy. Although one thing that I learned when I was researching my book is that she really did a lot of comedy in theater as well. You know, her breakout role at Yale School of Drama was The Idiots Karamazov by Christopher Durang and Albert Inarritu, where she played, like, a old hag in a wheelchair, and
I would be remiss if I didn't mention her role in The Marriage of Bet and Boo by Christopher Durang, also with Sigourney Weaver, which is one of the great contemporary comedies.
But this was like the first kind of movie that was a straight up comedy.
Yeah, she is. I was watching the behind the scenes making of She-Devil the other day because what else do I do with my time? You know, she called this the first comedy that she had done. And that she had spent years asking people, you know, asking her agents to get her a comedy, but nothing good had come along until that film, which is worrying for a whole load of reasons.
Well, this movie came at a really weird turning point for her career. First of all, it was the year she turned 40, and she talks a lot about turning 40. She said she looked at her husband on her birthday and said, well, it's over. I think she had a very pessimistic view of how actresses in Hollywood fared after 40, for good reason. She's kind of the exception to the rule of that. And she also said that that same year she turned 40, she got three different offers to play three different witches, which she all turned down. And I think that's a great observation about ageism, but I also love kind of speculating what the movies were and which witches she was asked to play.
It might have been The Witches. That was 1989.
Oh, yeah. I think she could have been offered the Angelica Houston role. I think one of them might have been Into the Woods, because I know that they were working on a movie adaptation basically since it was on Broadway.
Quick intervention, though. When they did the read-through of the screenplay of the first go-round of Into the Woods, it was Cher as the witch. And I think amazing. We can all agree that would have been amazing.
Yeah, it would have been amazing.
And then, I don't know, Hocus Pocus, maybe? That was kind of a few years later. It could have been in development, but... we'll never know. One of the mysteries. Which witches did she almost play in 1989? But anyway, the point is she had a kind of career freakout. This came right after the Dingo Ate My Baby. Again, no one knows the real title. Don't tell me. This was 10 years or so into her kind of leading lady career. And she had done The Accent. She had done all these sort of tragedies, these sweeping dramas like Out of Africa. Suddenly she does this comedy. She's basically the second lead in a B-movie starring Roseanne. How did this happen? And then very shortly after this, she split up with her agent, Sam Cohn, who kind of made her a movie star, or like sort of was the architect of her movie career. She really talks about the 90s as a lull in her career, where she was going back and forth, kind of careening between different genres, like kind of B comedy, and you know, her only action movie, River Wild, and well, whatever Death Becomes Her is, it's like a horror comedy. You know, she was nominated 4 times for an Oscar in the 90s, so that's her version of a career lull. But I think when you look at the Bridges of Madison County right smack in the middle of the 90s, that was like, it shows you that was the exception. And everything else she was doing, starting with She-Devil, was kind of like, why is she doing this? She almost like, either she wasn't getting offered enough things, or she was trying to reinvent herself in this very counterintuitive way. And I think She-Devil, in a way, is a protest against the kind of thing she had been trapped in, which is kind of noble tragedies.
But Sean, all this context is very, very interesting. But I just have to like let Michael know that while we were watching this movie, I was just like, okay, it's kind of boring and it's not that funny. You hated it.
Yeah, I really, really hated it. I thought it was an incredibly flimsy film. I really think Mary Fisher was a bad character. And I think, consequently, Meryl's performance is also really bad. She's not funny. There's 2 good scenes in the film. One where Mary Fisher takes back her house, which is in a kind of a long, unbroken, and very physical shot, you know, where she kind of like puts some of the kids in a headlock and like throws things and like, you know, spins around.
Stop that! Stop it! Take your filthy hands off her, Dorothea! You're fired! Get the hell out of my house!
I hate you.
You go upstairs, young lady, and take off my dress.
You're not my mother.
I said move!
And the scene at the end, where obviously Mary Fisher has transformed into this kind of Meryl Streep character.
She's a serious, you know, New Yorker, yeah, type writer.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, that's not really a stretch. I don't know. I just thought this film was flat. You know, who is the She-Devil supposed to be? You know what I mean? Like, her and Roseanne had, like, nearly no scenes together. What was the point of that?
Can I say at this point that I love She-Devil and I love her in it? And I was so happy to watch it again. It just made me love it more.
Okay, just defend yourself, Shulman. Okay.
First of all, this is a bit of a confession, because part of this might just be my own nostalgia. When I was like 12 or 13 or so, I liked this movie enough that I read the Faye Weldon novel it's based on. I read it.
I can one-up you. I read Ironweed.
Yeah, but still, like, what little, like, teenage, like, you know, pubescent boy is reading The Lives and Loves of a She-Devil by Faye Weldon? And let me tell you something. That book is not appropriate for 13-year-olds. It's really dark. It's so much darker than the movie. I mean, the stuff I remember is... So I think at the end, Mary Fisher dies. And then Ruth, not only does she ruin Bob and Mary Fisher's life, she physically transforms herself into Mary Fisher. So she like has this team of plastic surgeons that turn her into Mary Fisher. And the part that just sticks in my mind, because it was so disturbing, was that the character Ruth is like 3 inches taller than Mary Fisher or something. So she gets the doctors to figure out how to take out parts of her legs so that she can be fit, like, shorter. And the description of that was so unsettling to me that I still remember that's the main thing I think of when I think about the book of She-Devil. And then at the end, there's some scene where they reunite at Mary Fisher's grave, and, like, Bob has lost his mind so much that he just looks at her and doesn't even know what he's looking at. Like, he doesn't recognize her as either Mary or Ruth.
That sounds way better than the movie.
I might read that.
I don't know. It would be a very different movie. Anyway, why do I love this movie? First of all, there are a lot of other scenes I like besides the ones you mentioned, like Meryl scenes. For instance, when Ruth spills wine on her at the party at the beginning and she goes, "Salt and Perrier, a man who knows a woman's domain." And then I also really like this scene where she's talking to her editor and they're talking about the cream of watercress. And she goes, "It's a metaphor. A metaphor!" I just think she has a lot of moments where she can be haughty and... you know, she's playing a vain person, which there are a lot of things that carry over into Death Becomes Her, obviously, and Death Becomes Her is a sharper script with better lines. So Mary Fisher is a kind of prototype. One thing that occurred to me watching it again is that I do think that these two characters, Mary Fisher and Madeline Ashton, are a bit of Meryl spoofing herself, because at this point she had been this kind of queen of the Oscars, like tragic leading lady, and this sort of perfect person. I think that both characters, she's playing someone who you want to see knocked down, you know, someone who's the opposite of an underdog, and in fact is cast against an underdog, both Roseanne and Goldie Hawn. And it reminds me a little bit about the dynamic between her and Wendy Wasserstein, who were classmates at Yale School of Drama, because from what I picked up about it, you know, Wendy Wasserstein was this kind of, like, larger, unkempt girl who was very insecure and very sort of, like, klutzy and couldn't take care of herself. And then Meryl Streep was this just, like, blonde goddess who was not only beautiful but also talented, and Wendy was so intimidated by her, but Meryl was really generous with Wendy, and Wendy wrote, she'll never pass you a poison apple like other women like her would. So I think that in a way, Meryl Streep, by even taking this role, is kind of taking herself down a peg and playing off this idea that Meryl Streep is this perfect, rich, talented, beautiful woman.
That's really interesting, and, like, actually recasting the movie without Roseanne and with Wendy Wasserstein is, like, fascinating to me. Like, an actual frump, because I think the thing with Roseanne is that, like, she's kind of like a vulgar slob. Like, Roseanne totally seems out of place in this movie. And actually, I mean, we didn't get out a stopwatch, but I kind of feel like Meryl has almost more screen time than Roseanne in this, or at least she has quite a lot of screen time. But... And I'm no huge super fan of Death Becomes Her, as the two of you are, but, like, yes. It is far and away better than this, because, I don't know, Meryl's experimenting also with this, like, breathiness to her voice. Like, it just seems to me on the level of, like, a Saturday Night Live sketch. Like, at least Madeline Ashton, while not truly human, is kind of... a cartoon creation that has kind of multiple sides and insecurities, and, like, it seems like she has kind of like a backstory and flaws. Whereas, like, Mary Fisher both seems dumb and like the idea that she wouldn't know about taxes. Like, it's just like, you're, yeah, just like the dots of this character, like, don't connect from scene to scene.
Yeah, it's funny because
first thing, I think we should acknowledge that Mary Fisher, first of all, is a comic villain, and secondly, is a spoof. You know, she's a spoof of, you know, Danielle Steele, Jackie Collins, you know, all those famous romance writers, and she's an exaggerated version. And the whole point of her character is to set up this someone with an extreme kind of fantasy life that then gets, you know, progressively ruined and destroyed, and that we are supposed to love seeing her knocked down. So you have to start with this place. It's like someone who's sort of an invented character of their own.
Yeah, but Michael, imagine if Bette Midler was in a role like this, okay? And compared to the roles that Bette Midler did around the time, Big Business, Outrageous Fortune, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, one of my favorite roles of hers. Like, there was a period where Bette Midler was playing caricatures and spoofs and, you know, larger-than-life people. And yet at the same time, I could be like, I'm with this. I'm on this journey with this character. I believe that this is completely ridiculous. But there's something about Meryl being like, yes, I'm being a spoof of not only of myself, but of all these people. And all the pink. It was reminiscent of these kind of Bette Midler films of the time, but I just could not go along with it. And I know, obviously, it was practice for Madeline Ashton a few years later, who is, you know, far and away a better version of Mary Fisher, and who maybe wouldn't be as good as she is in that film if she hadn't got a dress rehearsal as Mary Fisher. I cannot endorse this.
To me, when I was watching it, it occurred to me that the obvious choice for this role in 1989 might have been Shelley Long. You know, because this was the same year as Troop Beverly Hills, and she's kind of like a Diane Chambers-esque character, and that she's a pretentious blonde, sort of nose in the air kind of person. That is more obvious, you know, to have a sort of sitcom star play this part. And I think it's so strange that this is the comedy that Meryl did. People, first of all, I should say, people really reacted against it at the time. Like, people could not accept that Meryl Streep was doing this. And I think that in itself is kind of admirable. I happen to think that as a feminist parable, I think it kind of still holds up. Looking back on it, I worried that it would seem really, really dated. But I do think that there are certain things that still really land in a surprising way. For instance, when you cut to sort of Roseanne's circle of women and the employment agency and everyone who's part of Vesta Rose, it's a very, it's a lot of different body types. It's very ethnically diverse. You know, there's the Asian woman who ends up working in the judge's office or whatever. It sort of anticipates a little bit of like intersectional feminism, not to get too like read into it too much, but I don't know. I worry that it would just be like, you know, so extremely 80s that it just wouldn't work on any level.
I'm with you part the way down that road. Like I definitely turned to Sean when Roseanne was starting the employment agency. I was like, oh, okay, this is like the broadly comic version of Carol Churchill's Top Girls.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's my main reason why I don't buy that it's fundamentally actually feminist. Mary is presented as this uber villain, and she's this uber feminine in how she thinks and how she talks and how she's bought into the role of what a woman's supposed to be. But, like, the real villain is Ed Begley Jr., and, like, he gets off virtually scot-free. Like, he goes to prison for what seems like
18 months,
an inordinately short amount of time. And then
gets rehabilitated.
There's no real, like, comeuppance for him. And actually, he's the one who's caused all this.
I don't know. I mean, I think it starts out that way, where she's talking about how Mary Fisher lives in the Pink Palace by the sea. I hate Mary Fisher. But I do think by the end, it's kind of generous to... There's kind of soft landings for all the characters. Like, the way that everyone's transformed is interesting, because, you know, Ruth ends up being a much more confident person who's taking control of her own life. Bob is in jail and receives the brunt of the punishment that she... But you also get the sense in that last scene in prison that they sort of have a better mutual understanding and a more mature relationship as kind of divorced co-parents. And then Mary Fisher, in the end, like, I don't think she's punished. You know, you see that she actually becomes, if not a better person, like a better phony. You know, the fact that she writes this novel that she reinvents herself as a writer and writes a serious memoir that gets her on Sally Jesse Raphael. And
no, that's true. Like, Mary Fisher becomes the best version. She basically becomes Susan Orlean or something. But
yeah, I mean, like, in the 2018 version of this movie, probably at the end, like, you know, Ruth and Mary would team up and you know, turn on Bob, which is kind of what happens in Death Becomes Her. But I also think it's so incredible to watch this movie now, knowing where Roseanne and Meryl Streep both wound up politically. And I mean, it's to think that, like, Ruth wound up being a Trump supporter and Mary Fisher is the one at the DNC's, you know, stumping for Hillary Clinton, is a real mindfuck when you watch it through the lens of this movie. And you know, what's incredible to me also is that just not to get into Roseanne for a moment, there's so much overlap between Bob and Donald Trump. I mean, here's a guy who is a sort of shady businessman who, and he has the same hair too. He has this like fluffy blonde hair, chronic adulterer who, you know, sexually harasses his temp. Yeah, it just amazes me to think that, you know, Roseanne was the force behind this movie as someone who wanted to punish the Bobs of the world. And now here she is, you know, 30 years later, being a vocal Trump supporter. It just doesn't make any sense, and it makes me sad about what happened to Roseanne.
Roseanne on her show was great and probably primarily a force for good. But, you know, it's interesting. In the early scene in the Guggenheim, I turned to Sean and I was like, oh, my God, if there's a Donald Trump cameo in this movie, because, like, I feel like that's exactly the kind of scene that he would have had a cameo in 1989, the way he does in
The
Associate with Whoopi Goldberg. That would have, like, been too much for me.
Okay, Michael, I think you and I have just agreed to disagree on this one. Although, you know, were it not for this film, we wouldn't have had Madeline Ashton, who is in my top three Meryl Streep performances of all time. Now, in the first episode, I asked Brian what his were, and I said what mine are. And I'm going to ask you the same question, okay? Top three Meryl performances. They do not have to be ranked in order. I just want to know what your three most favorite performances are.
My favorites are The Devil Wears Prada, Kramer versus Kramer, and Death Becomes Her.
Okay.
And what I always say about that, I think Death Becomes Her and Kramer versus Kramer have something in common, even though they're very different, which is that in each of them, the Meryl role was the villain, but she kind of turned them into the secret hero by, you know, finding some other dimension to them, and it wound up in a way sort of, you know, tipping the balance of the movie. So I think she's doing something similar in those.
Michael, we're going to give you some homework, which is to rewatch what you've been calling the Dingo Ate My Baby movie, which is actually has two titles.
It has two titles. So in Australia and New Zealand, it was called Evil Angels. And then everywhere else in the world, it was called... Michael, you know this. What is it called?
All right. It's A Cry in the Dark.
Yes, it is. Okay.
Because actually, that performance made it onto our list of our favorite Meryls. And I think it's... If you talk about someone who is positioned potentially as a villain who she complicates, like Lindy Chamberlain is definitely on that list.
And also worth noting that Meryl won Best Actress at Cannes for that role.
Mm. Interesting. Wait, before we leave She-Devil, we have to give a shout out to Linda Hunt, which I'm sure you guys did before you got me on the line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did. But, you know, poor Linda, you know?
What fascinating casting. Sean has a theory that actually Linda Hunt nabbed this role from one of his favorite actresses.
Okay, so I'm going to posit a theory to you, Michael. So, in the 1989, you know, tour of Sandra Bernhardt's Without You, I'm Nothing, she says, you know you're in trouble when you start losing roles to Linda Hunt. Oh, she's got another role? I'm so happy for her. And so I seem to think that She-Devil was the role that Sandra could have got.
But you know, Sandra was on Roseanne, so I wouldn't be surprised if... Like, somehow that connection was being mined for this?
I don't know if Sandra was on Roseanne at that point.
Okay.
But...
Well, I think maybe as they're doing with Roseanne becoming the Connors, they should just remake She-Devil as the Fishers and have killed off Ruth.
Yeah, that would be good, just with Meryl, and we could throw Linda Hunt and Sandra Bernhardt and everybody else in there.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for giving us your time to do this.
Oh, guys, it was a huge pleasure, and I love the podcast. I listen to it as I do the dishes and often feel like I talk back to you guys in my head. So it's just wish fulfillment for me.
Well, from now on, we're going to attempt to provoke you so much that you smash a few plates a la Sissy Spacek in the bedroom. You let him get away with everything.
Yeah. All right, let's let Michael go.
Okay.
All right.
Michael, go write some more brilliant prose.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye.
Why is everyone turning against me now? First Paul refuses to publish it. Now you tell me you hate it.
I don't hate it. I just don't know why you strayed from the formula.
Because in case you don't know it, Bob, I'm an artist.
Well, that was pointless.
It's really hard to convince an acclaimed New York Times best-selling author of something that he doesn't want to agree with.
You know, Michael believes what he wants to believe. He's not going to start listening to my opinions on She-Devil, even though he knows I'm right. Okay, he likes this movie. It has some particular point in his young adolescence reading the life and loves of a She-Devil.
Well, at least he had some nice things to say about this podcast, didn't he?
Oh, no, that was the best part.
No, seriously, Michael, you've been a wonderful guest. We really appreciate having you on, and let's not make it the last time.
No, that was great. Thanks, Michael. I really love that.
Yeah. So we hope you out there listening have enjoyed this very special series of episodes. Sean and I are going to take a break from doing these three-parters. It is taxing, and, you know, while someone like Meryl Streep may be able to constantly operate at the highest level, Sean and I need to take things a little bit easier. But fear not, that doesn't mean that broad appeal is slowing down in any way. In fact, we are gearing up for all sorts of new plans that we've got, and we're going to announce a very special little mini-season. Now, we've done mini-seasons in the past.
Yeah, we've done mini-seasons. We've done palate cleansers, and this is a palate cleanser.
Think of it as a lemon sorbet from a vintage filmic season. Yeah, does sorbet keep?
I think sorbet melts, Brian.
So you couldn't keep a sorbet that dates all the way back to 1987?
You could, but I don't want to eat it.
Okay, well, 1987 is the year in question. You might be thinking, why? Why, Brian and Sean? That's not like a 25th anniversary or anything. Well, sure. No, it's true. It's not.
It's not even a 35th anniversary.
It just happens to be a really interesting year for women in film. If I said to you a dinner party that featured Meryl Streep.
Uh-huh. Again. Her again.
Her again. Uh-huh. Her sometime nemesis and foil, Glenn Close.
Okay.
A bit of sparky fun from Holly Hunter.
Yeah.
Maybe number or two for Cher.
I love it, but I've got one more name to really make this party start.
Uh-huh.
Sally Kirkland. Okay. Can Sally Kirkland come?
I think she can. And of course, the invite list has not been determined by us. It's been determined by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, as no doubt you already knew.
No, I did.
But seriously, we reserve the right to just shake things up every once in a while. And what we're going to do is we're going to spend at least 5 episodes, possibly more if it takes us longer, to cover the 5 Best Actress nominees of 1987. So, if you want to start doing your homework, go watch those movies. You can easily find out which ones they are.
Yeah, they're all grouped together.
Yeah, they're all, I think, going to be worth seeing in one way or another.
Uh-huh.
No, but seriously, this is a really excellent lineup, and it's going to be interesting in this year of Cher, which we are definitely living through, as well as a potential year of Glenn Close, to kind of look back at those two women, to compare them to Meryl, to Holly Hunter in one of her best roles, and then, of course, it's always the year of Sally Kirkland around broad appeal.
I'm so excited to finally be watching Anna. Now, Anna is the hardest film to track down, but life finds a way.
So that'll be our next series for some week's time, and then we've got even more exciting plans in the works, which you will hear about. Thank you so much for all your dedicated listening of Broad Appeal. It is so good to be back. Do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review, or even better, just tell everyone you know, because now is movie season, it's award season. I'm sure there's got to be some crazy people out there who have yet to listen to us, and you, listeners, you can help spread the word.
Yes. And don't forget to follow us at Broad Appeal Pod, or I'm at Sean McGovern X.
And I'm at BA Mullen Speaks. Big shout out to at MJ Schulman, our guest extraordinaire. And we will be going back in time, way, way back to 1987. We'll be turning back time, Sean, won't we?
Yeah, from before I was born, man.
We'll see you very soon.
All right, bye.